Doing? All right. So it's a bit tricky not to fall asleep after lunch, isn't it? So if you do have a little doze off, I shan't mind. Well, I will actually mind. But, you know, I'm just trying to be nice. Okay, final session. I wanted to think about how we're called to walk hand in hand with God, how we're called to go on an adventure with God, and then this one, how we're called to walk hand in hand with other people. It's not a solitary walk, is it? The Christian life is not a solitary experience, and sometimes it can feel like it would be easier if it were. There is simply no getting away from the fact that we need to do life together with others. It is not enough simply to have an ecstatic experience of God. We need to live with others. And I think this can be good and bad sometimes. I think sometimes we look at the other people God has chosen around us and thought, really? But actually, we're built to live, to work best when we have really good connection with other people. And that's kind of obvious, really. And one of the, as I said, we run a centre, which is like a project based in the church. It's sort of in the basement of the church, because in London, you don't get much sort of space in general. So when we moved into the building, we dug underneath. It was a complete nightmare, I was telling Carol, but it was a total nightmare, the whole building project from start to finish, never again. But it was amazing. And we now have this kind of double space, sort of double decker church, which is great. So we do a lot of our work with families and children there. And we set it up as a separate project because we knew that some people wouldn't go into a church. And so we call it the centre because we literally couldn't think of another name. It took us forever. And what we really do is look at the relationships that we have, the key kind of family relationships, and try and give sort of professional and therapeutic support for them. Because we know that in our context, we wanted to be a force for good where we were. And we felt like one of the biggest causes of pain in people's lives is actually relational trauma. When relationships break down, particularly close relationships, it can be very devastating, as we know. And we wanted to be sort of a way of giving people the tools that they needed in order to carry on having really healthy, sort of thriving relationships. And we started with sort of babies and mums and dads, and we sort of progressed up. So now we do married couples and various things. We're about to embark on teenagers. See how that one goes. That's a whole other thing. Babies are easier. And what we talk about is really how we need each other, how we're built to really need and function best together. Now, I want to do a little exercise, which you are now going to embark on. So I need to pick a partner, and it just has to be two people. So you might have to move around again, but it's good, because otherwise you'll fall asleep. And then one of you needs to decide to be the storyteller. And then one person needs to decide to be the listener. Okay? So first I'm going to let you get into partners. Okay, now you need to pick who's going to be the storyteller and who's going to be the listener. Hands up if you're going to be the storyteller. It's not threatening, honestly. You can choose whatever you want to say. It's not like, I'm not going to ask you to do something really terrible. It's easy peasy, lemon squeezy. Okay? Okay, and now the listener. So hands up if you're the listener. Okay, if you're the storyteller, can you just shut your eyes? Honestly, it's not a trick. Just shut your eyes for a minute. Okay, and on here, there should be something which the listeners... Keep going. Ooh. Okay, and one more. Okay, listeners, I want you to look up at the screen now. And again. Can you read that? Oh, no, just, I'm going to tell you what to do in a minute. Okay, so what I want you to do, actually, I'll just explain it. It's going to get too complicated. Okay, you can uncover your eyes. Okay, what I want you to do is think of a story that happened last week, something that happened to you. It doesn't have to be like a story, as in Little Red Riding Hood, but just an event that happened. Don't make it too personal or too painful. So anything that you're just happy to tell your friend about. Okay, and then the listener, to start off with, I want you to listen as you might normally listen to someone, attentively, a little bit of eye contact, you know, nodding, etc., etc. So you show them that you're listening. Then when I knock on here, I want you to basically look like you're not listening to them at all. So just look up, look around, do whatever you like. And we're going to just have a little see of how that feels. Okay, first, attentive listening. 3, 2, 1, go. So, little bit of Q&A here. How was the first bit of listening? How did you, if you were the storyteller, how did you feel? For the first bit, but when they were listening, actually listening to you. Just felt normal? Yeah? Okay, for the, when the other person was trying to show you that they weren't listening, what did you find yourself doing? What happened? What was that? Huffy. Who found it hard to actually carry on thinking about what they wanted to say? Yeah. Did you find yourself getting more animated? Yeah. Did you find yourself getting cross? You couldn't carry on doing it. Yeah. So basically, normally, did anyone find it absolutely fine? It's normally parents of teenagers are quite skilled at this, carrying on through. In general, if people start giving us the signal that they're actually not connected with us, they're not listening to us, we, in our brains, we find it hard to be more, to be coherent. So we will find it, even if we know that that's what they've been told to do, it works even better if you can kind of if you can do it so they don't know why you've just suddenly started listening. But even when you know that they have been told to give you signs that they're not listening to you, it is very difficult to organize your thought processes. We do this, I do a lot of training for social workers on attachment, and we do this exercise at the beginning of the session. And we did one with a bunch of social workers, and when we said the thing, did anyone find it was absolutely, didn't make any difference at all? And one guy put up his hand, and my friend, who's a psychiatrist, she said, well, that's either because you're just experienced at carrying on talking, or you could be a psychopath. I can't believe you just told a social worker they could be a psychopath. Because psychopaths obviously don't have the same social cueing as the rest of us, and so they wouldn't actually care. But for the rest of us, I'm presuming there's not many psychopaths among us, for the rest of us, it's actually very difficult because our brains are wired for connection. And if I'm trying to tell you something and you're not listening to me, then actually that dysregulates me. And I find it quite hard. And that's just a really tiny example of how we need each other and how we were essentially designed to live in connection with other beings. So human beings are essentially created to be social animals. We function best in packs. We need people. We function best when we're with people. You know, going back to the psychopaths thing, you know, it's very rare to have a very violent sort of crime committed with people saying, I can't understand it, because they were so connected in with the local community. They are often loners, kept themselves to themselves. That social isolation. So social isolation is not actually very healthy for us as human beings. Actually, social inclusion and social, you know, interacting with other people is how we are designed to be made. And the exciting thing, because as you can tell, I like this area, is that at the moment, in the whole world of neuroscience, there's this, you know, sometimes we think that science is sort of slightly scary. We never quite know what they're going to come up with. But if in the whole realm of neuroscience, scientists and neurobiologists and social biologists and neurologists and psychiatrists and psychologists are all doing this incredible amount of work and looking at brains. And one of the reasons we can do this work is because we can scan our brains now. We can have an MRI scan. I don't know if you ever had one. I've had one. It's quite scary. And then we can also have an fMRI scan, which is a functional MRI scan, which basically tracks your brain and shows how your brain is actually working whilst it's working. It's kind of like a video in your brain. So we can now see into people's brains and see how they function best and see what happens when certain things, when certain conditions, when the person is in certain conditions, relationally, etc., etc., etc. So we have this huge amount of insight that we haven't really had. And the last 20 years have been this extraordinary explosion of scientific sort of knowledge in this area. And the fantastic thing is that all this knowledge points to the premise of Genesis, that it is not good for us to be alone, that we were designed to live in connection with other people. And even sort of quite eminent psychologists and psychiatrists who aren't Christians, so don't have quite the language, which, you know, would also talk about a sense of also being connected on a spiritual level. So it's a very exciting sort of area, and it's an area that I do a lot of reading in because we sort of teach it and do lots of stuff. Sue Johnson, who wrote a book called Love Sense, and she's a marriage therapist, she's a doctor, said this: "The first and foremost instinct of humans is neither sex nor aggression. It is to seek contact and comforting connection. Emotional dependency is not immature, it's not pathological, it's actually our greatest strength." And you can see that very clearly in, you know, when they went into orphanages in Romania or in the Eastern Bloc, and they looked at how babies were raised, and then those babies went on to be adopted, and they realized that the deficit that some of these children had from just the basic human contact had actually caused a deficit in their brains that was quite hard to recover from, and in some cases was almost impossible to recover from. So what we've begun to realize is that the things that we were talking at the back the things we naturally do with our babies, the way we talk to them, we hold them, we comfort them, we use a different voice, we rock them, all the things that we instinctively do with babies is actually building their brains neurologically. And babies are born really 3 years premature in terms of their brains. And so the first 3 years are incredibly important as to how we treat them and the conditions that they have. And if they generally have their needs met and it's generally a good experience and their parents are able to sort of be with them and comfort them and be kind and in control and all the things that we want to be, that gives them a really robust experience of life, and they take that on, you know, for the rest. That's like a template for all their relationships on an ongoing basis. And if conversely they have a more negative experience, then actually that can have an impact on them too. And I say that not to terrify any of us, but just to say that we are basically, you know, designed in an incredibly clever way. And God designed us to be in very close proximity with people. There's a professor, I think he's at the University of Virginia, called Jim Cohen, and you can look it up on YouTube. It's C-O-A-N, I think. I don't think it's C-O-H-E-N, I think it's C-O-A-N. And it's called the hand-holding experiment. And he put some volunteers, and he put them in an fMRI scanner. And he said, "I'm just going to give you an electric shock at some point. There'll be a beep, and then you'll get an electric shock. It won't kill you," because obviously the experiment would have been shut down had he killed them. Bad. They don't let you do that twice. But it will hurt. And then he wired all their brains up. And the first time they did it, or one time that they did it, they were completely on their own in the space. And they looked at how the brain registered the pain. And then the second time they did it, they got a stranger, so someone who was on the medical team, to hold their hand. And then the third time they did it, exactly the same level of shock, they got a spouse, or I think they were all partners, to hold the hand of the person in the fMRI scanner. And they found out, not surprisingly, that it was worse. So the brain registered the highest level of stress. So when we get stressed, we get something really called cortisol, which goes into our system and it kicks in a sort of fight or flight response. It's very important for us neurologically, but we don't want too much of it. Too much of it is a bad thing. So their levels of cortisol were were the highest when they were on their own. When there was a kind of stranger who was a sort of comforting presence, it was better than nothing, then it was slightly reduced. And when their partners were there, it was reduced. But even within that category, so these are people they knew, if the woman said, "I have a really close relationship with my partner," then the level of stress was massively reduced. And it was as if they'd actually taken a pain-killing drug. So it was so powerful. The human contact with someone we know is there for us and sort of has our back, is in our corner, was so powerful. It was like taking Nurofen or something even stronger. And so they didn't even register the same level of physical pain when it came to the electric shock. It's quite interesting, isn't it? See? Anyway, you can look it up on YouTube. He's got a ponytail. He's very cool. What we seem to need is, from main people in our lives, is two things. We need them to be a secure base, which is someone that we go out from to adventure. And this is definitely true of children. Actually, can you put that image, which has got looks like a child running around in a circle? It should be on the PowerPoint. Okay, the one before that. Ooh, okay, leave that one. Do that one, that's fine. That's okay, cool, perfect. This is based on some of the thing parenting stuff that we do. It's called Circle of Security, not the Circle of Trust, which is, you know, from the Meet the Parents thing, but Circle of Security. And basically, this is what we need. If we're a child, and in fact, as adults, we have exactly the same needs, we need our parents to be a secure base for us, which is to say we need them to allow us to go and explore. Exploration is an innate part of our life. And particularly for babies and young children, we need to explore, we need to adventure, we need to look at a different toy and see what that is, we need to work out things. We start off by exploring our feet, we explore our parents' faces. Exploration is a key part. And if you think about a child in, say, toddler group, the child goes in with their mum or dad, and as long as the mum or dad is there, the child will explore in general. You know, once they've got confident enough, they'll go and they'll find a toy and they'll pick up something and they'll quite like it, etc., etc. If the parent leaves the room, particularly if they're after about the age of 9 months, and the child suddenly clocks that the parent has left the room, what happens? Cries, yeah. Do they carry on playing? No. So we use our parents as a secure base to explore from. When that play, you know, when our secure base goes, we often find exploration very difficult. And we can, you know, the older you get, obviously, as children, they learn to cope with it. But at that key kind of developmental age where you can really see it in operation, exploration tends to shut down. And what we also need from our parents is we need to be able to come back to them when life gets too much for us. So we need them to be a safe haven for us. We need them to protect us, comfort us, delight in us, and organise our feelings, which is to say, help us make sense of our world and help us particularly make sense of our emotional world. So we know all this is fairly sort of standard in terms of teaching parenting. And it seems that, to me, it seems that God is actually like a secure base and a safe haven for us. If you think about it, when we think about, you know, how we live, kingdom building, doing things for him, we know that God is with us. He has our back. He protects us. He comforts us. He knows us. And we also know that when life gets too much, we can come back to God and we can know his comfort and compassion. So I kind of like this model because I think it sort of mirrors God, which is why I quite like it. We teach it to with parents of young kids. And it can really help us make sense of what bit of that do we find easy as parents and what bit of it do we find hard. And in general, we're probably more comfortable with either allowing our children to explore, being independent and confident and blah, 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 or coming back in for comfort. Some people prefer it when their children need them a lot of the time. And we generally have a thing that we find easier and harder. And some of the work that we do is exploring why that is. Why is it that we have these different strengths and these different things that we're kind of getting, but not just yet. We don't quite understand. And thank you. If you flip onto the next one, or the teenage one. Sorry, I'm being annoying. I did say it was going to be annoying doing PowerPoints with me, because what I do is I write the talk and then I do the PowerPoints, and sometimes I forget exactly the order I put the talk in when I do the PowerPoints. Thank you. This is the same circle when it comes to teenagers, and teenagers actually have a similar set of needs. And actually, as adults, we have a similar set of needs. We need people to be our strongest supporters, and we need people to be able to come back to you for comfort. And when we have those two needs met, of, you know, in the same people, then we can feel pretty secure. We can feel quite confident. We can have adventures. We can take risks in a good way. And life feels manageable and okay. And if we don't have that, then life can feel a little bit tougher. Ecclesiastes 4:9 says this: two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. So we were designed to live in close relationship with other people. It's not needy to need people. You know, my children will talk about, that when they were littler, so they would talk about, you know, oh, they're so needy. They're so needy. They just need you. Well, and it's just, it's always, oh no, I couldn't, you know, I couldn't be friends with them. It's just so needy. It's like, what do you mean needy? You know, everyone needs people. We need people. That's how we're functioning. I banned the word, which probably wasn't very helpful, but I find it a bit annoying. She said, thus undermining her entire credibility. But you know, what is it that makes someone needy? It probably means that you're more needy than me, or you're giving me more overt signals that you need me more than I need you, or you want to be with me more than I want to be with you. But we all need people. We need people. We function best with people. And if we don't have people to do that, then life is a lot tougher for us. So we cannot simply walk hand in hand with God in beautiful solitary isolation. We are also called to walk hand in hand with others. It's how God planned it. And fantastically, it's sort of really being proved time and time and time again in the scientific world. The problem is walking hand in hand with other people can be quite annoying, right? Right? Yeah, sometimes. I know, not here. You know, we feel that, Jesus, I love you, but some of the people that you want me to love are actually deeply frustrating. I've been married to a church leader for 22 and a half years, and I am amazed by how incredible people are when it comes to what they give and how they serve church. It is frankly awe-inspiring with people's time, which is really limited, what they come and what, you know, what they'll do. They'll come and set up really early. So if you're on the kids team, you have to get there for about 9 in the morning. And these are young people, and they probably got to bed about 3 the morning before. And they'll come and they'll set up all the toys, and then they'll run the kids program, and then they'll set down all the toys. And by the time they get to go home, it's about 1 o'clock. I just think that's extraordinary. Why would you do that on a Sunday morning? It's amazing. But also, people can be really annoying. And people can project onto you all kinds of stuff. That you, and it feels like, I think one of the hardest things about leading is you never quite get the chance to say back what you actually think about them. So they'll tell you what they think about you, you know, this and this and this, and you're like, you know, and one day you feel like, I might just say, but sometimes it's, you know, sometimes you can have honest conversations and sometimes you can't. It kind of depends how well you know them. And some of the time you feel like, I can see why you are doing this. I can absolutely see why you're doing this, but until you let me speak into your life and help you, I'm just going to have to take your rubbish. Does that make sense? So we can see sort of people on sort of repeat all the time, and it can be deeply frustrating. So church is incredible, and church can also be frustrating simply because we're in touch with people. Some people we find easier than others. You know, there's normally a reason for that. And we also have our own history. We have our own story of what close relationships look like. In an ideal world, we'd all have been raised by parents who were perfectly able to allow us to explore and who were perfectly able to comfort us when we needed help, who were able to be bigger, stronger, wiser and kind, who, you know, and so we grow up as, you know, happy, skippy, confident little bunnies that go off and embrace the world, and then we go on and have an ongoing experience of really positive relationships. But that doesn't happen in most of our lives. We have a whole different experience of being parented. And so we have a different sort of template, if you like, in our brains of what relationships look like. What is healthy relationship? What feels normal? What feels abnormal? Because we all have a history. So we may have learned that separation is a very dangerous thing. We might find that we always want more from other people than they're prepared to give us. That we always want them to share more with us than we'd never quite get there. And we're called clingy, or we're called demanding, or we're called high maintenance. And it feels like it's a little bit of a consistent theme in our lives. But we may have learned that actually struggles are meant to be dealt with on your own, internally, with no one else. And therefore, it's very difficult for us, and I would count myself in this category, to actually openly talk about current struggles. You see, it's easy to stand up and speak to you about struggles that I have gone through in the past. It's actually a lot easier. So people go, you're really honest. But it's actually much harder for me to talk about a struggle which I'm currently going through with the people I'm closest to. Because for me, difficult things were meant to be done internally, on your own, process safely. They were not supposed to be processed with other people. So when my husband would process all this stuff, I'm just like, what is wrong with you? you know, seriously, there is a thing called self-control and maybe exercise some. And he would say, where have you gone? You know, so you're now telling me you've been worrying about this for 2 months and you didn't say a word to me. You know, why wouldn't you say it? Don't you trust me? You see, so we miss each other because we've had different experiences of what actual relationship looks like. So we find it very difficult to say how we actually feel, because saying how we actually feel makes us quite vulnerable, and we don't really like feeling vulnerable. There's a clip, if you can, the Scrubs one. Do you think you can get that up? I'm going to show you a clip now of, it's Scrubs, it's just a medical drama, and one of the two key people is leaving the hospital, and the other person is incredibly sort of bombastic and never says how he feels, but actually he really has a lot of affection for his colleague, and so he gets tricked into saying what he actually feels about him. Is it going to come up? Here we go.
Things rarely go exactly the way you want them to, so sometimes you make do with whatever you can get. Good night.
Night.
He's finally gone. Talk about making a big deal over nothing, you know? I mean, Dr. Dorian was fine, but he was no better than any other doctor.
For the record, he was the best that ever came through this dump. John Dorian was the first and only doctor I ever met who cared as much as I do. And you can forget about him being just an exceptional physician. Because the fact of the matter is, he's a damn exceptional person. That's why people gravitated to him. That's why I did. He was my friend.
Thank you, God. That was beautiful.
Oh, God, no.
It's okay, Perry. You just said how you feel. Honestly, I am so full of your love right now, I literally could not take another drop. Brace yourself. I'm coming in. You smell like a father figure.
Oh, please stop.
Great job, Sonny. You said your line perfectly.
Oh, thanks. I worked on it.
I knew it would set you off. Good night, best friend.
He thinks I'm an exceptional out person.
You realize that even though he gets to leave, you have to stay.
I didn't think that out.
No, you didn't.
Okay, there's someone who finds it hard to say how they actually feel. And some of us will be like that. Some of us will find it very difficult to actually say even really positive things or difficult things to other people, because that's just not how I'm used to doing it. It doesn't sit comfortably with me. Or we may have had significant trauma in our past that we find all relationships a little bit threatening. And I think whatever our history, the fantastic thing is, as we know, that it is not that God takes us by the hand. Now, we can trust God with all our stuff, as we were talking about this morning, you know, because he knows us. So sometimes people will say, well, I don't really want to tell you how I think, because if I tell you how I think and you don't like what I think, then you're rejecting me and then I'll be rejected. God isn't going to reject us. So we have this incredible healing relationship, and we of all people know where healing is when it comes to relationships. So I think the church should be massively engaged in this area, because, you know, we know where the water of life is and we can help people in these really, really important things. We need to know our own story and we need to ask God to heal it insofar as it needs healing. And let's go back to Peter for a moment. If you can open your Bibles to John 21:15, I'll read it. If you haven't got it, it's fine. So this is now after we fast forward in Peter's life. We've gone through the Last Supper, we've gone through the cross, we've gone through Peter rejecting Jesus 3 times, as Jesus predicted, and now we've had the resurrection, and now they're meeting for the first time since Peter denied Jesus. So Jesus said at the Last Supper, you know, you're going to deny me 3 times, and Peter says, even if everyone in the whole world deserts you, I am going to be stalwart for you. I would never do that. And Jesus says, before the cock crows three times, you will deny me. And Peter does that. And this, so this is the first time they've met. When they finished eating, When they finished eating, Jesus says to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. And Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, take care of my sheep. The third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him a third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. I tell you the truth that when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you to where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, follow me. And then he tells Peter that he's the rock on which he's going to build his church. How do you think the other disciples felt? You know, a rock is supposed to be a consistent person. A rock is, you know, this unchangeable thing which is there. That's why a wise man built his house upon the rock, not on the shifting sand. And to date, Peter has probably done a better impression of being shifting sand than he has done of being rock-like. And yet, Jesus chooses him to be the rock on which he builds his church. And you think the others are going, really? You know, are you sure? He's quite a chameleon. Actually, you know, he says something's good and something's bad, but Jesus restores him and he asks him the question three times to enable Peter to say three times that he loves him. So Jesus knows that's incredibly important for Peter to affirm that love because he said three times that he didn't know him and he's called down curses on him. So he's basically showing both Peter and the other disciples that this relationship is healed, that this relationship is restored. He is forgiven, and upon this person, I'm going to build my church. And, you know, Peter did that because he knew, again, he knew what Peter's heart was like. He knew what he would become. He knew the person he would become, and he knew the person that he already was. And I wonder what we think in our own lives. If we met Jesus right now, what do we think he'd say? I think there's lots of areas in our lives that need transforming. But I think this is a time now to think about how we relate to others. So Jesus, how do I relate to others? Do I find it easy? Do I find people quite threatening? Do I find people quite sort of swamping? They always want more than I can give them? Or do I find it's really, really hard to connect in with people? What is it, Jesus? And is there anything that I have learned in my, you know, in my experience that actually isn't going to help me for the next stage of the journey? Because we're always changing and being transformed, aren't we? So is there anything now? Search me and know me. You know, see if there is any offensive way within me and lead me in your light and in your love. And I think that's a really good prayer to pray. Because we don't want to be repeating the same patterns in our relationships again and again. We don't need to be on repeat. We just don't need to. And as soon as we begin to recognize it, we can begin to actually choose and, you know, do it differently. So in our family, we didn't really do, when I was growing up, we didn't really do anger in any way. Anger was not okay. Anger was probably dangerous, and there's a reason for that. But I kind of grew up learning that really one shouldn't be angry and one shouldn't express anger. And so when I had my children and they would have their tantrums, I found it really difficult. So I'd find myself literally being panicked by the fact that, you know, and no one really likes children having tantrums. You know, it's not a nice room, especially when it's in public, which it normally is. But I would literally freeze. And I would then either try and shut it down by being more angry with them, or I would try and distract them out of it. So we didn't really go there when it came to anger. And it wasn't really till I had a chance to think about that. I'm thinking, actually, you know, we all get angry, right? Anger is anger. We feel angry. And what we really need is a mum or a dad or a partner who can say, oh, I get that. I'm sorry you're feeling angry. it's okay to feel angry, and I'm sorry that's what's going on. As opposed to, you don't need to feel angry. Why are you feeling angry? What's going on? Why are you cross? You know, if you think about coming home from work, having had a bad day, and your partner says, how are you feeling? And you just go, oh, I just feel really annoyed with so-and-so. Well, why? Well, they just said this thing, and it really hurt me. Well, you shouldn't. Well, you know what you should have done, don't you? So annoying when people do that, don't they? Immediately, they go into trying to solve your problem. You do not need them to solve your problem. Deeply irritating. You just need them to go, oh, that was rubbish. I'm so sorry. And then you can begin to work it out for yourself. If someone comes in with, well, you know what you should have done? You should have said this, 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 this. You're already not listening to them because you're just like, now you're being irritating. And why do you always try and solve my problems? I'm not trying to solve your problems. I'm just trying to help, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Much more useful if we can say, I totally get that. It's really annoying. It's the difference between empathy and using everything as a teaching moment. Empathy is really important in our human relationships because empathy says, I am going to try and choose to enter into what you are feeling. I am not going to stand over you and tell you what you should be feeling. You know, that's sympathy. Or that's, there we go, empathy. Very good, you're good. See, If I have empathy with people, I take their perspective. I think Jesus did this with Peter. I say out of judgment, you know, well, obviously, if you hadn't done this, you wouldn't be feeling like this. Awkward. I recognize that they're allowed to feel an emotion, and I communicate that. It's not ever saying, at least. It's not ever really saying you should, although there are times for speaking into people's lives. I think probably our greatest need in terms of walking this life with other people is actually probably focusing more on empathy, because that gives us a platform then to speak into people's lives. There's a little clip, which I think I'm going to play some of now. How long have we got? Oh, good half an hour. Okay, that's the one with the kind of Victorian lady.
So what is empathy, and why is it very different than sympathy? Empathy fuels connection. Sympathy drives disconnection. Empathy, it's very interesting. Teresa Wiseman is a nursing scholar who studied professions, very diverse professions, where empathy is relevant, and came up with four qualities of empathy. Perspective taking, the ability to take the perspective of another person or recognize their perspective as their truth. Staying out of judgment, not easy when you enjoy it as much as most of us do. Recognizing emotion in other people and then communicating that. Empathy is feeling with people. And to me, I always think of empathy as this kind of sacred space when someone's kind of in a deep hole and they shout out from the bottom and they say, I'm stuck, it's dark, I'm overwhelmed. And then we look and we say, hey, calm down. I know what it's like down here, and you're not alone. Sympathy is, ooh, it's bad, uh-huh. No, you want a sandwich? Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because in order to connect with you, I have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. Rarely, if ever, does an empathic response begin with at least. And we do it all the time. Because you know what? Someone just shared something with us that's incredibly painful, and we're trying to silver lining it. I don't think that's a verb, but I'm using it as one. We're trying to put the silver lining around it. So, I had a miscarriage. Oh, at least you know you can get pregnant. I think my marriage is falling apart. At least you have a marriage. John's getting kicked out of school. At least Sarah is an A student. But one of the things we do sometimes in the face of very difficult conversations is we try to make things better. If I share something with you that's very difficult, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now. I'm just so glad you told me. Because the truth is, rarely can a response make something better. What makes something better is connection.
Okay. And again, I think as Christians, this is even more important that we don't have to, you know, if the trouble with, the reason we don't go for empathy is because it is painful to feel what other people feel. So if someone I love is telling me something that they are sad or that they are frightened or that something is overwhelming them, and I choose to engage in that, it means that I have to feel what they're feeling. I kind of enter into the experience. So I'm choosing to enter in. And we don't want to do that because we don't like feeling sad or frightened or overwhelmed. And so what we will tend to try and do is flip it into looking on the bright side or giving a Bible verse or doing anything to not feel that. And actually what people need most of all is they need us to be big enough and strong enough and kind enough to say, I will choose to allow you to feel what you are feeling and I will feel it with you. And then together we will get through this. And it's after we've had that bit of connection that we can then do, especially if we're parents, that we, you know, because we do need to speak into situations, we can then begin to speak into it. But people don't hear us as well if they don't feel that we've got their back, if you like. So I'll give you an example. I was, my littlest daughter, who's 13, we had supper and she suddenly started having a go at her brother and sister about towels on the bathroom floor, which they are disgusting slobs. And she started shouting, I just can't believe you. You know, you're bitter, disgusting. What is wrong with picking up? You know, why can't you pick up towels? And like, massive reaction. We were like, whoa. So I get in the car, I have to take her to swimming. And I'm like, that's quite interesting. You know, are you okay? And she said, because we've been doing this a while, she said, there is not a softer emotion under this. I am just really angry with her. But I was like, oh, okay. And then she said, she burst into tears and said, I have no friends at school. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness. So she's in year 9 now, but this is when she was in year 8. And these are all the thoughts that are going through my head. I can't change her school. I don't, there's nowhere else she can go. This is the school she has to be in. I don't want her to have no friends at school. I know that she's got people she talks to at school. So my instinct is to try and convince her that she has friends. So that's like and then I think, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to try and do a way of empathy because I've just been teaching a circle security group, which always makes me nicer. And so I say, okay, I'm going to try and go with what she's given me. So I say, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry. That's awful. Yes, it's really awful. Is that my phone? Oh, never mind, just leave it. You know, that's really awful. You know, if I was, you know, where the place I went to every day, if I didn't have any friends, I'd just feel quite sad. I feel really sad. And I'm thinking, because this is, bearing in mind, this is all lasting like seconds, really. I'm thinking this is not working. She's not getting out of it. And I said, yeah, no, I get that. That would just make me feel very on my own. I'm really sorry that you're having that experience. And then she says, well, I suppose there is Beatrix. Oh, really? Yes, there is Beatrix. I do talk to her sometimes. And then basically, by going down with her, and this is what we know sort of is absolutely true in terms of human relationship. If we can choose to go down with people and allow them to feel what they're feeling, it helps them feel better so much faster than pushing them to feel better. So had I gone in with, well, how about Beatrix? You told me you talked to Beatrix yesterday. It would have been a fight. Because now she has to convince me that Beatrix isn't actually her friend. And, you know, even if it's true, you know, it's kind of how we get to the truth. And so basically, by doing it, it enabled her to kind of come out of it. And I think that's a really important gift that we can give each other, especially in church, of allowing people to feel what they are feeling, to just be with them as they're feeling it, which enables them to actually, you know, even outside of God, it enables them to feel better. And even more so when it comes to the access that we have to a Heavenly Father who loves us, who is passionate about us, and he will always hold our hand and be with us. And I think we can get taken out of doing that. And that's when we can end up being a little bit more false or cheery or silver lining it. And it's very easy to silver line things. Sometimes I do an exercise. I teach interns sometimes. And we do different scenarios and what you'd say to different people in the situation. You know, if a relationship breaks down or blah, 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 blah. And I always put one list of Bible verses in every one of the choices. And I absolutely believe all these verses are true. But I also believe that, you know, if you're feeling really, really sad, you probably don't need to be told to rejoice. And again, I say rejoice. You just don't need to hear it at that point. It's still true, but you don't need to be told that because that is missing, you know, where they are. And I think we have this great gift to each other that if we can actually choose to be with people in the way that Jesus was with Peter, then, you know, God is ultimately our source of healing, but we can also really help each other. I think it would be good to pray now, don't you? I had one last bit. That was really all I wanted to say in terms of walking with God and walking with other people. And I think if we can get both of those in balance, we can have an extraordinary time in terms of how we see God work in our lives and how we see God just work with the people that we love. And we're up for that, right? So when you were pairing little groups, did people get pictures? Was it quite interesting? Did you surprise yourself? Who was actually surprised that they actually had something that meant something to one of the other people? Okay, yeah. So when we do that, you know, we're just asking God to speak to us. That's all we're doing. We're just saying, and sometimes we say things that are, sound a bit weird. But they can be very, very powerful for another person. And even the fact that we're prepared to say it, to be honest, is quite powerful for other people.